Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building and growing consumer brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space. A product that people buy in grocery stores is an entirely new business, and I had a lot to learn. So in my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on production and distribution, sales and legal, PR, and social media. Then I started having those conversations here, as a podcast, so that other entrepreneurs can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand, because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with John Lawson, Northeast Regional Grocery Buyer at Whole Foods Market. I feel like it's a big coup. I really do. I'm like so excited that you're here.
Thank you.
Yeah. John has been super, super helpful getting Haven's off the ground. I mean, we'll talk more about that, but thank you. And I really am so thrilled that he's here to share all of his advice with other emerging brands. So John, yay. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we met, we basically had a prototype. I don't know that we had any actual way of producing or distributing our product. But you helped figure out everything from distribution to pricing. I didn't listen at the beginning particularly well, but all of the stuff that I kind of try to do on this podcast, you basically helped me do. And I know I'm very fortunate that I got you as that person.
So. You have a great idea too. So
thank you. So going back, mm-hmm. You've heard the podcast before, you know, I like to sort of know what you were like as a 9-year-old, where you grew up, were you quiet? Were you naughty? Were you fun? Naughty. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where naughty came from, but you know, like what were you like? Were you into food? What did you want to be?
When I was a kid, I think I was sort of all over the place. Mm-hmm. I think that stretched into my early adulthood as well. I know that at one point I wanted to be a veterinarian.
Aww.
That sort of came and went. And then I was going to be a writer.
Okay.
So grew up in Charleston, West Virginia.
Cool.
So, from the, Appalachians, moved around, and ended up in New York. But, when I was 16, I became a bag boy at Ellis's grocery store.
Got it. And that was the beginning.
I never knew that I would end up with a career in food retail, but that's sort of where I started and, learning how to bag groceries.
So. Right.
It was a good experience.
How did it? First of all, for some reason, also you're really into music, aren't you?
I enjoy right. a lot of different.
But you
types
never
of music.
Wanted to be like a musician.
No, I mean, like, I was in the marching band.
Okay.
I played the tuba. So
you were not naughty. Essentially.
No.
It's hard to imagine like a marching band tuba player being like too much of a.
Oh,
like,
we had a good time in band.
Oh, band.
Not the stereotype you're
like
thinking
band
of.
Band camp.
So, yeah,
right.
it was a good time.
Okay,
so.
All right. I definitely
lots
don't
of
throw
fun
shade
kids.
On the band.
No, band
crew.
Was great. So.
So you got into grocery through literally bagging groceries.
I did that. I did that as a kid, and then, graduated high school, went on to college. English major, figured that I would be a writer or something, and whatever I thought I was going to be. It took me 3 attempts to get through college, so
okay.
Geographically up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and then finally ended up in New York
right.
Working as a photographer.
Oh wow!
And did that for maybe 10 years.
Really? That's and a then, lot. I mean, that's a long time.
It's a long time. Yeah. That's my past life.
Okay.
Realized that photography wasn't really, you know, I didn't have the skill, mm-hmm. that certain je ne sais quoi skill to, yep. to be a New York Times photographer.
Right.
And in the meantime, I'd been working at a co-op called the 4th Street Food Co-op, which mm-hmm. is still on East 4th Street between 2nd Ave and Bowery. And it's a little, I think it's what, like 800 square foot with lots of bulk, and nobody owns it. The members own it, and anyone can shop. Members get a discount. So
very cool.
My little plug for the old co-op, which I worked at like 20 years ago.
Do they have an Instagram? We can tag them, or
I have
they're
no
like too
idea.
Cool to have an Instagram.
No idea.
Okay, it's well, if they do, Maddie, time. We'll tag them.
So
8th Street.
4th Street.
4th Street.
4th Street Food Co-op. So they, you know, I worked there for a long time, learned about, you know, all the natural food customers through the 90s, selling a lot of like soy milk and tofu and like fresh tofu and things like that. A lot of bulk products, you know, learned a lot of different things there while I was pursuing this photography career.
Right.
Then at a certain point, I decided I really liked retail.
Yeah.
So I let go of the photography and went to work at ABC Carpet.
Right.
Did that for a couple of years, realized that I'm also not a matchy-matchy kind of guy.
Right.
So I basically just applied at Whole Foods in 2004.
For what job?
I just applied. I didn't even know what I was applying for.
Wow.
And I got into the a career development program,
right?
And open Union Square, and then
that's so cool. This is
Jericho.
So cool.
Yeah, so you know, learned, you know, worked on the floor for 5 years,
right?
And then moved to Chicago as a regional buyer. Was there for 2 years, and then came back to New York.
So you were the Midwest regional
buyer, I was the just promotions buyer there.
Right, okay.
Gabe was and still is the regional buyer there, and then came back to New York 2 years later as a regional promotions buyer, and then. Started working on categories about 6 or 7 years ago.
Wow. And so that's just kind of amazing. You've been there for like 15 years.
Just coming up on 15 years.
And what, I mean, this is stuck more than anything else is stuck. Is it Whole Foods in particular? Is it the job is just dynamic and fun? Is it meeting young brands? Like what do you love about it?
You know, it's supporting entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
It's learning something new every day.
Yep.
I mean, every week there's something new happening in the food world that is super interesting. As an English major, I've gotten a whole finance education.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think of this as my grad school.
Think of this as my grad school.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's a good you know, on the ground grad school. I was always much better at doing things than learning things.
Yeah.
So this was a much better way to get a quote unquote MBA.
Right. No, it's awesome. All right. We're going to take a little break early, because I have so many questions that I want to just have the back end all just loaded. So we'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbalk cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Andrew Friedman, and I'm the host of Andrew Talks to Chefs here on HRN. Every week, I interview a diverse cross-section of the best and biggest names in professional cooking. Give a listen and get to know all about the inner lives of chefs. You can find Andrew Talks to Chefs wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm back with John Lawson, Northeast Regional Grocery Buyer from Whole Foods Market. I don't know what the... what the word is. It's not veneer. It's like there's sort of, you have like a mystique, I think, around you a wow. little bit. No, because you're like, you're a serious person. You have sort of the keys to the kingdom in a lot of ways. I feel like you've discovered a lot of brands and been a big part of their success. And it's just kind of exciting getting the opportunity to ask you these questions because people are going to really want to know. So how many new brands do you see probably every year-ish? What are some promising signs that you see? And then what would you say are some red flags where you're like, not going to work?
I mean, just in terms of just net brands, hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
Via email and people who just cold mail packages. Some of the things that strike me are packaging, like mm-hmm. Solid packaging, strong call-outs that are on trend, areas that are, you know, everyone, one of the big questions I always get is like, what's the white space in grocery? And of course, if I had the
sauce,
the perfect answer to that, then I would, you know, I would probably
go make a product
and go make right. a product. So, and also because there's so much happening in the food space, the white space is it's not, there's not like a flat white space to look at. You have to find angles on it. Yeah. So someone will come into a category that, or a subcategory like right. the sauce that mm-hmm. where you didn't think there, you felt like that's space. Another thing. Yeah. And then you realize that, okay, there's actually an opportunity in this space to there's a crease that you can, exploit and, right. and sort of grow the category and, you know, give customers something new and exciting yeah. and on trend.
And red flags are when it's just like a tired category and a product that really doesn't differentiate itself?
Or? Yeah, the lack of differentiation, the Me Too, not hitting the key points. You know, if something is like really positioned well for paleo and then it's or keto and it's full of sugar.
Right.
Things like that where occasionally you'll see something and you'll give some advice to say, why don't you make a couple of changes to this, and this. And if they go back and come back with it, I always have to include the caveat that that's not a commitment. I'm going to pick up the product.
Right.
I'm giving you free advice.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they'll come back with it and you'll see something really cool and then you'll be ready to move, right. you know, to move forward with it.
Are you ever sort of seeking out, okay, we need a new fill in the blank or like this part of the store is looking a little tired. It'd be really great if I could find a chickpea cereal or, you know, something like that. And then do you ever go seek out brands or is it mostly just incoming because you're kind of flooded with people like me?
Well, it's a lot of incoming, occasionally seeking something out, but you know, mostly it's what you're seeking out is somebody who's already doing something. And then the line extension sort of makes sense to cover other areas that,
right.
that make sense. But you know, we've got so many, especially in New York metropolitan, we have so many great entrepreneurs mm-hmm. who are doing cool things and are coming up with those ideas on their own. They yeah. don't necessarily need, they don't need me to tell them what those ideas are. They're coming to me with even cooler ideas than I could possibly come up with for right. them.
And do you ever do discovery? I mean, I know you go to some shows, but do you feel like you have enough kind of coming at you that you don't need to go out and find new products, or do you feel like you're kind of always looking for new products?
Always looking for new products
yeah.
and new ideas. I mean, you go to a restaurant and a chef comes out with something and it's like,
right.
well, okay, wait a second. Maybe we can figure out something with this. And, you know, like we've talked about a lot, I'm a cautious growth guy. So,
yeah.
you know, if I get someone excited about something, you know, I don't want to make them think, hey, you're going to launch this and it's going to be amazing.
Right.
It's, you know, I'm going to invest time and shelf space, but you know, it's a long road for anyone to, you know, once you have that germ of an idea to yeah. actually put it in the soil and get it to grow.
Yes, it is. Can we talk a little bit, since you brought it up, can we mm-hmm. talk a little bit about cautious growth and kind of what you mean and how the regions work a little bit, you know, in the sense that when you, for instance, when we launched at Whole Foods, we launched in not even a whole region of Whole Foods. We launched in 14 stores in your region. There are brands, I guess, that launch what's called globally, which means that they're launching in all the regions. How, you know, I know that you like to kind of build a region, make it strong, make the mistakes early on. Can you just talk a little bit about that process, or can you tell us a little bit about how the regions work?
Sure. I mean, my cautious growth philosophy is around the idea that a brand that launches in New York Metro, really a brand that launches anywhere, has an opportunity, has shelf space, you know, is going to need to find distribution, is going to need to learn how to run promotions, yeah. run demos, which you've done a lot of.
We've learned.
And there are a lot of mistakes to be made. And if you launch in all the stores of Whole Foods Market, which is, you know, a great opportunity for a lot of folks, you get sort of one chance to make those mistakes. And if you make too many of them, you might lose that opportunity. Mm-hmm. But if you're in one region and you get to make some of those mistakes and you're partnered with your regional buyer, you know, in that case, me for Northeast, then, you know, we give you some bandwidth, some runway, whatever the term is, to make those mistakes, to learn through trial. And then as you sort of establish that foundation, then I feel like you're sort of ready to expand
into the next region.
Yeah. All the stores in the region, and then go to the next region.
Right.
Because you can go in with a much more solid game plan and strategy for growth in that region. And every region is different. So different customers, different price sensitivities, mm-hmm. different flavor profiles. So you go into another region and you're going to have a whole different set of learning.
Right.
So I feel like the brands that are best positioned for long-term success are the ones where they've really built that relationship store by store, region by region.
You know, it's so funny because Mike Kerbin, the founder of Vita Coco, was on the other day and he was saying, you know, core then more is the way he termed it. And so many people say that, you know, start with a core community, build out from there. And yet I feel like there is this sort of pressure to like go big. You know, it's hard to do marketing, honestly, when you are only regional to some extent, because you have to be only regional in your marketing and you don't want to have like, you know, it's like there's a challenge to it also. You know, everyone kind of wants you to sort of be this big, bold brand, and slow and steady, you know, not even slow, but like slower and steadier, you know, does, I think, win the race. But it is kind of hard to balance that sometimes, I think, if you're a founder.
Well, especially in the world of social media and where, you know, everything is sort of accessible from anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, not like the old days where, you know, it was circulars in the newspaper and things like that. It's you know, you put it on Instagram and the whole planet could see it, theoretically.
Right.
Except for certain countries where they can't.
Speaking of Instagram, has it changed your job at all or your role or any part of it?
Yeah, I think Instagram blows things up a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a brand, a product that customers will really break down the doors and, you know, rush the aisles to get their hands on this hot new product.
Right.
And we've had a number of those recently. You know, they do really well, but then they run into production issues, and then it's a hard time staying in stock, and then it becomes, you know, the question of you know, when's it going to come back?
And right.
It's always
and
sort
people
of
have a quick a forget pain point. Memory. You know,
most of the ones that have been recent have finally figured out their production,
right?
Because they launched and they just weren't ready for that rush, and then when they finally figured out the production, their sales settle in, and it's not like they've fallen off.
Right.
You know, but you do have to figure out the production within a certain period of time.
Yeah. I mean, for founders listening, I feel like I divide everything between like ops and sales. And those two, it's like a Venn diagram, you know, and in the middle is like demand planning and promotional schedule and, you know, figuring out some sort of even R&D, you know, like what's going to make sense for the sales side needs to be margin accretive on the op side. But if you don't kind of get those two things, like those two pillars kind of figured out, it took me about a year, but my guess is that's probably average-ish.
That would sound about average.
Right.
I mean, it really depends on the brand. I mean, some brands just come on the scene, figure it out, and just off to the races. And I mean, the sort of the polar opposite is, I mean, we launch brands that we're excited about, and sometimes they just can never figure it out. So
right.
we're always rooting for the brands. I mean, it is one of the joys of the job when you launch something and you sort of give the advice
and you watch it.
They figure it out. Blossom. And you watch. Yeah. Yes. That seed grows and turns into a beautiful flower.
Yeah, so. We're hoping.
Or a tall tree.
Yes. We're a seedling right now. Is it kind of true? This is a random question, but I feel like a lot of people say like, well, if something's going on the shelf, something has to go off the shelf. Like, it's a store. There are only so many shelves and slots on shelves. And are you... Every time you bring something new in, are you kind of taking something old out?
I mean, that's brick and mortar. That's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
You know, we have a limited amount of shelf space, especially in the refrigerated section. As you know, it's very, very tight. And so anytime you bring something in, you've got to make the space to put it on the shelf. So it's basically one in, one out.
Yeah.
So it's competitive.
It's competitive. That's intense. Yeah.
And brands... You know, brands get the opportunity on the shelf. And mm-hmm. so a lot of times a brand will say to me, you know, thanks for the support. And I always think of it more as in terms of an investment.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made an investment in your product with the shelf space, which has a certain value.
Yep.
and time and labor from our teams.
Yep.
And in return, we expect the brand to go in and actually do the work to grow the sales, you know, through the promotions and the demos and the social and...
So I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, you and I have talked about this. I think that I miscalculated a little bit at the beginning how powerful social media would be and probably undercalculated or emphasized how much we needed to do in the stores. You know, that's a combination of not knowing the system, also not really understanding, you know, how a demo isn't just getting the product into consumers or potential consumers' hands. It's also showing support to the buyers at the stores and that there is this sort of this real relationship that needs to be built between the brand and the buyers. What would you say, I know it's different for each category, but what would you say to a new brand that's like, starting on a few shelves at Whole Foods, this is how many demos you should probably think about doing. This is how you should think about promoting. I mean, I know that it depends, but is there a general way you can kind of tell people what to do?
Yeah, a lot of it is working backwards. So for the pricing piece, you have the retail price that you go out on the shelf. That's your SRP, your suggested retail price.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to know what that, you want to have done the research for your category or subcategory that you know exactly how much you want to sell for on shelf.
Right. And we talked about this, sorry to interrupt you, mm-hmm. but there's a couple episodes back with our outsourced CFO named Dawn. It's from Relish Food Project. If you haven't listened to that episode, listen to that episode because we break down like how much the distributor is going to take, kind of what, if you want your SRP to be $5, what your costs need to be and to not mess that up too much.
And that's an important one to listen to because I think that's a place where, you know, a lot of brands spend a lot of time making sexy packaging and figuring out this whole go-to-market strategy, but pricing doesn't feel sexy to a lot of people. It feels like a lot of work and a lot of math, and a lot of people cut math class and didn't want to deal with that. And so I feel like that's part of the... it's a key part of the equation because if you have the right price point and you're accruing the right amount to promote and you're hitting that right price point on promotion, which is the yellow tag in our stores, then those are your demos. That's your trial samples when someone actually buys the product on sale, goes home, tries it, loves it, they'll come back and buy it again and again. I mean, at its most basic, you can have demos alongside of that. I don't really give a number for demos.
Right.
I mean, like you were talking about getting to know the buyers, you really want to just get to know your store, get to know your customers, get to know the team members in the store, and for Whole Foods Market, they'll constantly rotate. So this person will be at this store, and then in 6 months, they'll be at that store, And so it's just a constant sort of cycle of renewal and getting to know people. But they'll carry that to the new store too. So you build that enthusiasm and then they take it to another store. And so it's cross-pollination to stay on that theme.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny because I guess it makes sense. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know how important that was. And I think especially for us, because when you start off in a couple stores, does everyone not start off on the planogram, or does everyone, is it unusual? Like,
no,
or is it a couple?
We have local brands
that
start off in sometimes one store.
Right.
And sometimes they just stay in one store and they just continue to sell that one store. Some of them expand to more stores. Some of them really take off and do great and get planogrammed.
Right.
Once you're planogrammed, then you're part of the schematic that on the reset month, the team goes into the store and actually resets it. And according to that schematic, your product has to be on the shelf in a certain place.
So the planogram, for anyone who doesn't know what that is, you know, for a region. Right.
It's by set size.
Okay.
So for us, we do it by set size. So, you know, you have different set sizes and each set size has a different map that tells you where the product's supposed to go. And so some products are on all the planograms.
Right.
Some products are only in larger sets
because
the smaller sets can just really have a core mix.
And if you're not on the planogram because you're a local product, you're basically getting squeezed in somewhere where there might be an extra little space.
And that's where you really have to get the enthusiasm and the buy-in from the teams.
Yeah.
So they get excited that, of course, I'm going to carry this product. Yep. Customers are going to come. If I take this off the shelf, I'm going to hear from the customers. You know, I really like this product. I like the demos they do. They help me turn the product.
Right.
So that's those are big components.
It's super important. And it's funny because I you know, I guess, how would you know?
You listen to this show.
Okay. what are some of the fundamentals that you wish, like, for example, someone like me would have had locked up before I actually came to you? You know, before I was ready. I thought I was ready to go on the shelf. I probably wasn't entirely ready. It took us like 6 months after you said, like, let's try to figure this out for us to figure out production and distribution. And then it took us another 6 months to figure out a promo schedule and demos and, you know, pricing even. And I appreciate your patience with that. But for other people listening, what are sort of the key things you want them to have in place before they're really ready to come to you?
Obviously you need to have your package. You need to have a UPC.
Right.
That's a very
basic
piece.
We had that.
Piece.
We did have that.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think you were as unprepared as you thought you were.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we get a lot of brands that come in and are in some stage of readiness, have something really interesting. And so, I mean, a lot of the job is patience. Like, you know, you have to be willing to, you know, work with someone through the process and frankly, to allow them to make the mistakes because everyone comes in with a different background, with a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes time for people to sort of wrap their heads around it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think it's as easy as like, here are the five things you need to have coming in. But you know, you want to be able to, I mean, I would say be made it in, you don't want to be made in your home kitchen.
Yes.
Like you want to have a space where you're having product made. You know, you want to know what your capacity is.
Right.
You want to be able to talk about your capacity. So, you know, if they come in with a chocolate bar and it's amazing, oh my God, we're going to put this in all the stores.
Right.
And a lot of brands don't want to say no. Like, oh, they're going to put it in all the stores. But, you know, it's just, you know, it's like seeing the train coming tied to the tracks and it's just going to run you right over. So, you know,
it's hard to say no.
Being realistic though. And
you
know, if they say, I'm going to put you in all the stores, saying, hold on a second, I can supply two stores.
Right.
Okay. So we'll do two stores.
Right.
You know, we're all very patient and, we want it's in everyone's interest for the brands to succeed. So we just need to understand transparency, communication. I mean, buzzwords, but also,
no, that's what I was going to ask about the companies that you really enjoy working with. And you had said something about you want to know if they're going to be out of stock before.
Yeah, that's a big one with me. It's just important that brands communicate proactively and don't try to – a lot of brands will try to hide issues. And the issues always come out. So just be straightforward with it and trust that, you know, again – I think a lot of times people, the brands don't think about us as investors in their project, their product. And it's important to treat us like an investor and give us, you know, if you want to change your packaging, your UPC, your ingredients, you know, give us a little bit of, give us a little bit of heads up on that. And, you know,
it's great to know,
to have some input and, you know, we're not going to tell you, we want to hear what you're doing and understand. And, but it's the same for out of stocks and everything else. Anyone who's listening to this, who's had a conversation with me about out of stocks knows that it's a big, big thing. So,
yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, we changed our peanut to cashew. And I'm happy we did it. It was a great decision. But I mean, you definitely walked us through that process, and it wasn't an easy process. I mean, again, I think it had more to do with allergens, and there, you know, we needed a sticker to just sort of say a new thing. But if, you know, it was, I definitely remember talking to you about it and being a little nervous before the conversation that you were going to be like, you know what, forget it. I don't want any of them.
Like, yeah,
you're out, you're done, you know.
And yet we never comment anyone that way.
No, so. I know, it's just kind of funny because I remember like being like, okay, I'm gonna call them now. Are there, and you don't have to name names obviously, are there brands that you thought had a ton of potential and you loved and you were really psyched about and they just didn't make it?
Yeah, I can think of some. I mean, I'm the shopper who I bring something in I really like. Not everything is based on my own taste. There's plenty of things that I don't get that do very well. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of respect for them, but it's just not something that I would buy personally. But there are brands that I brought in that I'm, oh, this is so good. I love it. And it just doesn't do anything. And then I have to disco it and kind of breaks my heart a little bit because I was the one person who was buying it. Those are probably all my sales.
And so, I mean, it really comes down to the reason why they ultimately didn't make it was just a function of not selling as opposed to, you know, other issues that, I don't know, production or, you know,
it's usually lack of sales. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
how long do you give someone? And like, is there a sort of standard? I mean, for instance, with us, like I know that our velocity is very good just because I think it's just empirically good. And all we can do is like kind of measure it against like sauce as a category. But we don't know what the high limit is yet. I mean, we think it's good now. It could be even better. Who knows? You know, but you know what, do you have like a kind of, they need to be selling at least like 2 units a week or something like that. Like how do you,
it really depends on the category.
Yeah.
And you know, it depends on how interesting the product is, you know, how closely we've worked with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say 6 months to a year is,
you give it a shot.
You've got 6 months to a year to sort of figure it out. Higher velocity category, less time. So chips, yogurt, things like that are going to be a lot, you know, you've got to figure it out a lot quicker because the space is a premium. And there's, you know, for every brand that's getting a shot on the shelf, there's 10, 100, 1,000 other brands that would like to have that same shot. So it's really a calculation of have we done everything we can do with this brand? Is there anything we've missed that would have really, you know, lit the fuse to
help
take
it
off?
Right.
And without, you know, barring any of those things, you know, it'll, you know, it's a tough conversation, but you know, I think usually the brands sort of understand that it's coming, so it's not a
And I mean,
not the favorite part of my job.
No, I would imagine. And I mean, I'm sure in between there's like, let's try some more demos and let's promote a little bit more. And, you know, let's try to get it into people's hands. Yeah, that would really, I think that would depress me a lot. Any brands that you think are doing it especially right now?
Yeah. do you want me to name brands?
I mean, I think you could name a few. We can give props where they're due. And what is it that they're doing that you think is making them do it right, you know, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a brand that we launched in the Northeast a few years back, Bonza, is doing really, really well.
They come up a lot on this show. We had their head of operations on very early. But Bonza, I feel like people bring Bonza up a lot.
Derek, good, but
he's great.
Yeah, they're,
what are they doing great? Tell me.
Great product line. Just really connecting with customers. Mm-hmm. It's very communicative. You know, great guerrilla marketing, really on trend with their new rice product. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think they just really they've sort of cracked the code on gluten-free pasta.
Yeah.
In some respects, just pasta in general.
Yep.
And have just created an excitement. A lot of us, you know, we've talked about that, the orange box. And I think a lot of us at first, like, oh, I don't know, that orange box, yeah. It's awfully bright.
Yeah.
But, you know, they stuck to it and have really made an iconic statement with that. So,
that's true.
You know, that's one where my advice might have been, you might want to think about something else.
Right.
And, you know, I like to say I'm right 25% of the time. So I throw a lot of advice out there.
Right.
And, you know, I think they had a vision and they've stuck to the vision.
Yeah. No, they're doing they do great on social too.
Yeah, there's like One Culture. Do you know One Culture? He's doing the bone broth soup cups.
Oh, no.
And then he just at Expo West, he launched a line of vegan soup cups.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, we've been working with them since Hansen's the founder. He launched a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And the sauce is, he still got the sauce, but now he's really focused on these bone broth soup cups that are really, really, just really well designed.
Similar to Nona Lim?
Like, Nona Lim is more refrigerated,
right?
And so his are shell.
Oh, these are
shell
like
stable
cup
cups.
Of noodles 2.0.
Yeah, like right. the Mike's Mighty Good. I can't remember the exact name on that one, but you know, there's a number of them. But the cool thing about One Culture is they're actually dialing in the geographically where it comes from and sort of tying it back, you know, from a foodie perspective, historically. So I thought that was really cool, and the colors and the graphics are really nice
awesome.
On it. Really pops.
I'm gonna go for
another one is Dang that we've worked with. So and they've got his those new keto bars that are that are fabulous. So
I'd love to sort of break down like how they're doing it well. And I guess, I mean, there's no real formula, obviously, or everyone would be following it. But it does seem like there's a connection with consumers for sure. There's an identity, you know, these brands know who they are for sure, you know, and they're not like wafting around trying to be all things to all people. And it seems like they're actually truly innovating.
They are. I mean, every one of these brands is doing, I mean, like Sir Kensington, Siete, just really, really interesting, great graphics, you know, colors that pop, great stories. I mean, you know, Dang is a family story. Siete is a family story.
Yeah.
Even Bonza, I mean.
Yeah, the brothers.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel like there's an authenticity that I think sort of translates through to the customer.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that Scott goes out and still does demos from time to time for the Bonza. So, and likes to sort of brag about how much he can actually sell during a demo. So,
I know. That's what, I mean, it's funny because I also had, Pat Jamay on here. And I mean, they used to sell hundreds of Sir Kensington's ketchups at demos. I mean, he had the record, I think, or someone had the record. I mean, they sold a lot in a demo. That's a particular gift to be able to sell that much in a demo, you know.
Sales is huge, so that's not to be underestimated.
No, not at all.
And especially as the founder to go in and do the demos,
because
you can really connect with that customer and you can get to know your customer one-on-one. And you know, build that relationship and get that feedback. And sometimes you'll hear that same feedback over and over and you'll be like light bulb.
Yep.
And that can drive a really good correction for the
brand. It's funny because when I do demos, I used to be really uncomfortable because it felt like hawking my wares a little bit, like, you want to try some sauce? You know, hey, you know, like, and the woman's like, please, no, like, please leave me alone. You know, and I always felt like I was harassing someone until I switched it around into, what are you going to do with the chicken? Like, how are you going to make that lamb? Wow, I see you have eggplant. Can I help you make that better? Because did you know I have a cooking school? And, you know, and all of a sudden, I think when I turned it from, gosh, like, I'm another one of those annoying, like, used car salesmen into, I'm actually doing what I set out to do in the first place, which is help people make dinner quicker and easier. You know, it was like a mindset change.
And to the point of cracking the code, you know, I think every situation is unique. And so you just keep sort of playing around with it until you get the right combination. And once you find that, and that's the same with price point and promo price point.
Then you go.
And packaging and all these, like once you figure it out and you know you've got it, then you just, that's, you know, that's when you know you've got that foundation under you and you're ready for sort of your next step in the evolution.
Yeah. No, it'd be really, I mean, I feel like I could draw a timeline from like all of this and say like, this is where you are and this is where you need to be before you kind of press the pedal to the metal. And don't let, whether it's investors or other retailers or other brands or what you see on Instagram, make you feel like you're not pushing the pedal to the metal soon enough. Like, get your ducks in a row, you know?
You have to go at the pace that you're comfortable at.
Yeah.
So, and that's some brands that will, you know, sell in that one store forever. And if that's the pace they're comfortable at, we're happy to keep selling them in that one store. So
as long as they're selling.
As long as they're selling. We're very supportive of that.
Yeah, you are. That's definitely, I've seen that. Best way for founders to communicate with you without harassing you or annoying you.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big conversation at Expo West, you know. So founders are salespeople. You know, that's you're selling
we
your
have to be.
You're selling right. your product, not in a bad way. Sometimes people say, "Oh, I didn't want to email you because I was going to bother you." Mm-hmm. I'm nervous about saying this for posterity
because you're going to get a lot of emails.
But I get a lot of emails. Yeah. So, but you know, I feel like if someone has something, they need to reach out and they need to be persistent without being rude.
Yes.
And they need to be understanding, you know, of time limitations. And they need to listen. A lot of times I'll send something back and I'll put very specific directions in it and they don't follow the directions. And so I don't, you know, there's only so much I can do to help someone sort of with that first step. But, you know, I dare say that I'm never bothered by too many emails, you know, but sometimes I just can't answer them all. And so I try to answer them all and I try to, just give that piece of encouragement or just the thought on what they're doing. But at a certain point, I have to sort of let go and move on to the next thing as well. So,
and you have a lot of brands that you're managing, not just the it's ones that want to get in there, right?
Yes.
I mean,
existing brands and
yeah,
it's and transitions. We love the transitions. So,
I mean, I feel like you've given some good warnings. You know, don't grow before you're ready to get your ducks in a row. But are there any sort of other warnings or, you know, words of advice or wisdom or caveats you'd like to give to founders that are starting out?
You know, I feel like the brands that succeed are organized. Mm-hmm. They have a strategy. The strategy is adaptable. So you can adjust the strategy and, you know, based on feedback from my team mm-hmm. or from customers or buyers in the stores. Mm-hmm. Brands need to have energy. Like you can't go out there low energy. Like you've got to get out there and be willing to push it. And, again, I mean, I just can't say it enough, you know, that we can provide the shelf space, but we don't provide the sales.
Right.
You know,
the
brand has to really pull the customer in and sell the product. So, it's a challenge. I think a lot of people think that the last step is getting onto the shelf at Whole Foods Market.
No, yeah.
And that's
the first step.
That's the first step.
It's so amazing. I mean, I can think about when I really did. It's because it's so exciting. You know, it's a big deal and it's exciting. But then you're like, oh, wait. It's like, did you ever see The Graduate? And, you know, when they get on the bus at the end and he's like, Elaine, and he crashes her wedding. Okay, now I've lost you. But basically, he breaks up her wedding. They get on the bus. They're on the bus. And, like, the last scene is, like, them kind of like, okay, well, now what? You know, like, now what?
Yeah.
You know? And it's all about the now what.
What's the happily ever after, right?
Right. Well, right.
The myth of the happily ever after, where there's a lot to go after that.
Yeah, exactly.
I was reading about Nathan Chen yesterday, and he was talking about, you know, winning the gold medal is great, but there's a life after you win the gold medal, and there's probably a lot more special things going to happen in your life after that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, he's focused on going to school right now, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
so,
that is cool. I think we underestimate, and I do think in the age of Instagram, and especially because, of course, when you have a brand and you have a community that loves that brand, you assume that everyone loves that brand, and you're like, the world wants this. But the reality is it really is up to you as the brand to make sure that as many people try it as possible. And the best way to do that is to build the relationships with the buyers.
And the customers.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to build all those relationships. And frankly, brick and mortar, for all the the rumors of its demise.
Yeah.
Having that one-on-one connection with customers and buyers at the store level is your most basic touch point for long-term success.
Yeah. People are getting a little tired of digital. They are. Analog, man.
Yep.
Going back to the 8-track.
or something like that.
Or something like that. What is the most fun you've had in your job?
I think the most fun that I have on an ongoing basis is putting all the planning and work into launching a product. I mean, we have a very long launch process at mm-hmm. this point. And, you know, you initiate the relationship, you go through all the, you know, all the components of the launch, and then the launch comes and you see it on the shelf, and then you start to see the numbers come in and it's doing very well.
Yeah.
And that's very fulfilling because, you know, I'm not the entrepreneur. I feel like I'm the...
You're the entrepreneur babysitter.
Yeah. I'm the conduit for the entrepreneur to be successful in Whole Foods Market. So,
yeah.
You know, I take great satisfaction from seeing a brand, you know, really take off and do well. You know, and I support all of our brands, even the brands that I get mad at sometimes. Yeah. I still support them and feel strongly that they, you know, they do a good job, and everyone's entitled to make some mistakes. I mean, that's the nature of the business.
Well, I have to say, like, you never said I told you so. Like, we had a conversation about pricing, and you're like, I think it should be this. And I was like, I want it to be this. And you're like, okay. And then a couple months later, I called, like, tail between the legs. I'm like, you were right. You never once, not once.
Well, I do. I mean, I respect, you know, you're the founder, and I respect the, you know, your thought process goes into it. And it's, you know, it's really a matter of respecting your vision as well.
Right.
And letting you, again, because you're in that limited number of stores, if you make a mistake, it's going to be, it's not going to, if it is a mistake even.
Yep.
Because when you learn, it's not necessarily a mistake.
No,
right?
It's a good learning experience.
Because then you've got that in your, you know, and you won't stumble that way again. Right. So,
well, I just want to thank you again for everything. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you, Whole Foods Market, for allowing John to come on the show.
My pleasure.
And other founders out there, I'm not going to give them your cell phone. I was going to like joke and be like, it's 646. Just kidding. Anyway, we'll see you next time on In the Sauce. John, thanks again for coming, and have a great week.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.